Greetings and welcome to the Cerebral Women Art Talks podcast. I'm Phyllis Hollis, your host. As an extension of my Instagram page, Cerebral Women, this podcast offers insights into the visual art world. I interview artists, mainly artists of color and female artists, who will freely articulate what inspires their creativity. In addition, you'll hear interesting perspectives from dedicated art professionals who work with artists and the art institutions that feature them. I'm confident that collectively, these individuals will indeed stimulate your mind as they do our eyes. Please know, these interviews are conducted in my Manhattan apartment, so please forgive the background sounds of city life. Welcome to the Cerebral Women Art Talks podcast. This episode features Helena Metaferia, an interdisciplinary artist working across collage, assemblage, video, performance, and social engagement. Her work integrates archives, somatic studies, and dialogical practices, creating overlooked narratives that amplify BIPOC femme bodies. She received her MFA from the Tufts University School of the Museum of Fine Arts, attended the Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture. Recent solo exhibitions and projects include the RISD Art Museum in 2022-23, Museum of Fine Arts in Boston in 2021-2022, amongst others. Her work was included in the Sharjah Biennial in the United Arab Emirates in 2023, the Tennessee Triennial through the Frist Art Museum and Fisk University Art Gallery in 2023. Helena's work is in the permanent collection of institutions, including the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, Sharjah Art Foundation, and the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in New York City, to name a few. Her work has been written about in publications including the New York Times, Financial Times, the Washington Post, Boston Globe, ArtNet News, the Art Newspaper, and Hyper Allergic. Helena is an assistant professor at Brown University in the Visual Art Department and lives and works in New York City. Enjoy this episode featuring interdisciplinary artist Helena Metaferia. Thank you so much, Helena, for joining me on my podcast. I am enthusiastic about sharing your voice with my listeners. So let's get started with, when did you discover your artistic passion?
I feel like when you are a creative person, art finds you. You don't go looking for it. I was a child who could color and draw and do all of those things for hours and hours. And many people tend to stop over time and figure out some other kind of passion, but I just kept going. And I got the encouragement of my public school teachers and grade school and elementary school and high school. And then maybe you could make a profession of it. It was something that came along. So I didn't even know you could be a professional artist. I just happened to demonstrate some sort of creative interest and people that nurtured me along the way. And most of them happened to be Black women. So I've always been in the lineage of some phenomenal Black women educators who were at first public high school teachers all the way through when I was at Morgan State University at an HBCU, and then through graduate studies where I studied with the artist Maria Magdalena Campos Pons. So I've had two very fortunate instances where I just happened to fall in love with something at a very young age. And I happened to be encouraged and nurtured by people who knew what could be done with that talent.
That's wonderful, especially when it starts at an early age. Looking back, how do you feel your art professors impacted the work you're doing today and your practice?
So again, I didn't know that I could be a working artist, like that was actually a profession. I didn't have any artists in my family. I just had the encouragement of school teachers, starting in mostly in high school with a teacher I still keep in touch with today. Actually, I'm about to text my high school art teacher to invite her to a talk I'm giving this weekend in my home state of Maryland. So yeah, it's just been very fortunate circumstances. I credit a lot of my sense of self and the sense of possibilities of what I could do to the lineage of Black women. Dr. Monifa Lavasante, who was actually my poetry professor in undergrad, really helped me to identify Maria Magdalena Campos Pons, who was my professor in graduate school and who I went to study with. So she, when I was in a period of confusion in my 20s after undergraduate school, after, you know, many years of struggling it out as an artist, she introduced me to Magda and was like, do you want to study with this woman? She would be amazing. And I had never been to Boston before. And at the time she was teaching at the museum school at Tufts University. And I did a visit with her. I just had a conversation with her and she loved my work and she saw something in it. And she was like, just come study with me. So I have a very unique story and that I didn't apply to a bunch of graduate programs. I went to a historically Black college in undergrad with a general art training. And then I fell into this beautiful trajectory of working with now a recent MacArthur Genius winner who took me under her wing. I became Magda's TA and her student, and she was my advisee. I still perform with her whenever she calls me. So most recently at the Brooklyn Museum a few months ago, I performed with her for her retrospective, but 10 years of performing with Magda around the world. And so that relationship has changed. It used to be that she was my professor and now it's that she's still very much a mentor to me, but we have become colleagues and I am now in the position of teaching. I am a professor at Brown University and I also mentor young people who come through in many different ways. And so that oral history, that oral tradition that the art world offers through critique or through osmosis is something I learned from the women around me. And I pass on to the students that I have that are the next generation of makers. So there's a pedagogy of mentoring. And really, I'm so blessed that other Black women have opened those doors when it has not always been the case, right? There's this idea of competition or there can be only one, which happens when you're living in a racist, classist, sexist system, as we all are. And those women have showed nothing but generosity and grace. And that is something I have learned from my role models and I hope to model to others.
Well, there must be something special about you. And it's great that you appreciate what they've done for you and look forward to giving back. It's wonderful. Thank you. If you were not a visual artist, what career path do you think you would have taken?
A lot of my art has to do with issues of social justice. And I am somebody who is a researcher. I enjoy researching in the archive. I really thought through what kind of career path I wanted at an early age when I had to choose in my sort of professional studies moments in college. And I went into visual art, but I also could have been a journalist. Like I'm very much interested in documenting what's happening on a ground level. For me, it just became, I had these two passions of writing and thinking analytically in this sort of maybe more literal way. And then creating in a way that could be not so literal. And I just had a long-term writer's block, to be quite honest. But I never had a block with a page or a canvas. I never had a block with creating a performance. I feel very fortunate that just spills out of me. And words sometimes felt very limiting. I couldn't express everything I wanted to say in a very literal way. Sometimes words got in the way. And when words get in the way, I can make things out of apparently nothing to make sense. I find visual communication super impactful. I still work with the archive. I still work with the relics of what journalists have left behind, mostly ways in which Black and BIPOC communities document ourselves. I'm mostly interested in the archives we leave behind, such as Black Panther newspapers, different social movements that are archived at libraries around the country. And so I'm constantly digging myself up for that, for source materials, for collages or for tapestries or installation work. But yeah, that inkling to be a journalist has now formed somehow in this other way of working with the document.
That's great. How do you define your practice?
My practice is super interdisciplinary. I don't bind myself to one dimension of two-dimensional work or three-dimensional work or fourth-dimensional time-based work. I flow in between. And what I love about being an artist in the art world is you don't have to define your practice so much. You can be hyphenated disciplines or multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary, which I identify as, or transdisciplinary beyond the medium. Most of my work is very conceptually driven, and it is driven by an interest in seeing how change can happen in collaboration and community. I'm interested in things such as social engagement and social practice and what creates and cultivates authentic spaces. But then I might make an object from that. I might make a relic out of that, which can be in the form of a collage or a video piece or an installation. I also work in performance. Sometimes I use my body and the bodies of those in my community. And we take up space very much in, like in the language of activism, which is what I'm interested in. So there is this cross-pollination between the idea and the material and the medium, and there is a fluidity between that. And that is how I sort of define my practice.
Lovely. How has your technique developed or changed over the years?
I started being an artist in the public school system in Maryland. So I was introduced to all the things that most people get introduced to in the beginning, such as charcoal drawing, gesture drawing, and painting, and oil painting. And I stuck with painting for quite a while. I majored in that in art school, first going to Tyler School of Art and later transferring from Morgan State University for undergraduate school. And I stuck in the realm of painting all the way through my 20s and into graduate school at 30. And here I am making everything but painting, although sometimes you'll find some acrylic in my studio and it's going on top of some sort of tapestry, but I'll be wearing the tapestry and performing with it. So my block with painting was two parts. After many years of following that and getting involved in painting, the first block was that it's incredibly white male centered in terms of the canon of art history. And when I got to graduate school, that was the canon I was supposed to recite and cite and uphold. And this sort of prompted me into much more activist oriented work. I have a whole series called Refiguring the Canon, right? So I'm really interested in changing that narrative. And the second thing was it has its limitations. I love painting for what it is, a material setting, but I can't shout with a painting like I can with performance. And I'm interested in art as activism. So like many feminist artists, I've turned towards collage as a way to rip and tear and shred the document and to make sense of history in a new way and turn it into a mythology. I'm interested in performance because I can use my body and take up space and call attention, not towards myself, but towards an issue. I look at the trajectory of someone like Howardena Pendel, who I think of in my art fairy godmother lineages, as somebody who, although very much a painter and a collagist, had to move into video art and performance art through her Free White 21 video, where she talks about institutionalized sort of sexism and racism that she experienced in this very in-your-face way. So that's how I've grown and changed in my practice very physically. And who knows, I'm actually picking up the paintbrush more and more these days. Who knows if that will re-enter my practice, but I've kept my practice so open that I don't have to pick a team. I can just say, I want to be an artist.
Wonderful. How do you keep learning?
Well, that's a very good question. I feel like if we're not learning, we're not growing. And if we're not growing, we're dying. So we should always be stimulating our minds and our hearts and giving ourselves new experiences. Inspiration is one of the biggest things about being an artist. And so I have to be around inspired people. I have to be in community of amazing people, which I happen to do, you know, not just here in New York City, but nationally. And I, of course, read and I, you know, ingest information in multiple ways that are prepared and packaged for me. But I mean, I learn from all types of people and experiences mostly. So that could be engaging with my niece and my nephew, and they're teaching me something new about what this generation's up to. You know, that could be spending time with the elders and thinking about how history is embodied in their aged body, right? And so I guess that's the social practice part of me, is that I learn through conversations and dialogical experiences. And yes, I love reading and I am an avid reader. And yes, I will tolerate the news for what it is. And of course, I'm on social media like everybody else, probably because of an addiction that I would love to curb. But I rather be in conversation, and very much like this podcast, which is a dialogue, sort of dialogical art in itself. You know, it is a way to sort of hear through the voice and through the tones of the voice, a nuance towards a history, a story, a narrative. And that's really refreshing for me.
Yes, I love the work I'm doing. Do you feel Black art can be defined?
I don't even think Black people can be defined. I feel like that's a product of a racialized system, right? I think we're all humans at the end of the day. And yes, we have different cultural differences and different genealogies, but how do we define Blackness? I don't know if I can answer that question, because I'm still struggling with how to define ourselves as humans on Earth in 2024. So no, I don't think it can be defined. And one thing I've learned is, and I always say this jokingly, but we are not a monolith. We are not a monolith. Like, I mean that from every sense of the word. You can find another Ethiopian American person from where I'm from, grew up where I grew up, and we have different experiences, even within the same family, you know, we are so different and varied. So why lump us all together? But yes, I understand, you know, stereotyping and all that stuff has a great shortcut method that makes it like a cheat sheet. And so if we want to lump Black people together, why not Black art together? Why not lump that together? And so I don't have any parameter that I operate in my medium, in my own practice, and in my own identity. Nah, I'm going to like skip that one. I don't think we can define that.
When you're working, when you're creating, do you think about who your audience is?
I work with multiple audiences, and I don't think I'm going to please and have everyone love my work. But I do work on multiple scales. My favorite audience is under age 10. If they can't understand my work and they can't access my work, I miss something. But I'm a research-based artist. I teach at an Ivy League school at Brown University. So I also have this sort of high intellectual audience that I know patrons my work. And my work is often shown in museums. So I fluctuate between the more cerebral crowd, the intellectual crowd. But then I want to make accessible work. I don't want to be just a conceptual artist. And I'm not going to dismiss anyone who works in this way. But, you know, I don't want to be a conceptual artist who's made work that's so difficult for the majority of humans to understand that they can't have a conversation or feel moved by it. So I work in a very accessible language on purpose. I work with iconography in my collages. A lot of them stem from my Ethiopian history and my Ethiopian art history. I work with esteem building, very Black is beautiful motifs that have a record of empowering and moving people in activism work. I work with images and the archive. I also work with abstraction and conceptual motifs, but not in a way that you just can't access it from lived experiences. Like, I don't need you to have an Ivy League education to understand my work, right? But I also need to be able to maneuver those spaces because those are the spaces that fund and support my work. So how do you address all of those audiences in a single work? You absolutely cannot. And therefore, you also realize not everyone is your audience. Your work speaks to who it's supposed to speak to. And that's even from a spiritual perspective, right? Like, I am not out here recruiting people and saying, love me, love this work. I am being myself, making the work in the world, using my education and my tools. And yes, I think about, is this visually communicating to a wide range of people? But no, there's no way that everyone will appreciate or love what I do, because not everyone will love and appreciate the color blue or the color purple or whatever combination I've put together in front of their eyes.
And when do the titles of the work enter the creative process?
So the titles of my work are so boring, Phyllis. Like, I make my art so dense. There's so much information in my work, but my titles are the exact opposite. They are like headdress number 52 or whatever, like, you know, race car number 7. Like, they give some sort of clue as to what you're looking at. But I work in series and I usually number them. I was told not to do that because from a market perspective, you shouldn't tell people how many of those things are out there. But I disobeyed that because conceptually I figured if I'm going to make an army of women rocking badass collages as a, you know, headdresses and rocking history, I'm going to let people know there's an army out there all over the world of representations. And all of my collages that deal with images of women are women that I've interacted with through workshops and social practice engagement. And not everybody wants to be photographed. So if I've got 100, which I don't have yet, but if I have 100 collages out there, that means that there's at least 100 women who've gone through my workshops that have been impacted in some way and also want to come and show up and show out looking like a baddie in their finest fit or their sweats, however they come, to be photographed for this work. I also work with people on the front lines. I'm in the process right now in my studio of doing a collage of Nicole Hannah-Jones. I've worked with Ayo Temeti, who's a founder of BLM movement. So Nicole Hannah-Jones is founder of the 1619 Project. So there's like people more on the front line that are part of my work. And then there's also folks that are just like everyday folks, but they all get a number and the title and they all hold rank in this army.
Yes. And I'm sure they don't mind having a number.
Yeah.
So share with us, what are you excited about right now? What do you have going on?
I, like typical Gemini fashion, always have a bunch of different things happening in the studio at once. at this moment, I am preparing for some solo exhibitions this year, all at institutions. So I have a solo project, two solo projects happening concurrently, which I look at as one project. And that's happening in the New York City area. So in Brooklyn and in New York at the Center for Book Arts and at Recess Project. That's coming up in May 2024. And then they're both in advance of the national presidential election. In San Francisco at both YBCA and MOAD, I have a presentation in October 5th, 2024. And so these actually are coast-to-coast explorations of my By Way Revolution project, where I am creating workshops and arming women of color in the lineage of activism. And that's really exciting for me. There's a filmmaker that's following me to document this work from coast to coast. And I'm really excited about the release of that film in 2025. It's a short documentary on it. And then simultaneously, I have group shows that are touring and traveling, and they've been traveling since 2023. So currently at the Peabody Essex Museum is the show Ethiopia at the Crossroads, which highlights contemporary through medieval Ethiopian art. And I'm happy to have some work there. And then also in Houston at the MFA Houston, currently there's the show called Multiplicities, Blackness in the Contemporary American Collage. And in that show, and then last group touring show is this show at the Des Moines Art Center currently. It's a five-year run. It's through Independent Curators International. And I tell the curators, you guys are my longest touring troupe. We've got a family building out of this, the artists and the curators in this show. So that's been traveling through ICI. It's curated by Fitzim Shibshibe, and it's called States of Becoming. And I'll actually perform at the Des Moines Art Center live. I believe it's April 13th and 14th, I believe, somewhere around that time, 14th, 15th. And yeah, so that's where I'll be.
Busy, busy. Well, that's a lot. Share with us, what is your workspace like?
So I have been very blessed to have some free workspace in New York City and in Newark, New Jersey. So I'm part of Silver Art Projects currently, and that is in the World Trade Center. And Silver Art Projects is like a, I would say, four-year-old organization. They started in 2020 during the pandemic. And it's about 28 artists who have a collective space. We have our own individual studio spaces, but we share it on one floor, on the 28th floor of the World Trade Center. And the World Trade Center has a history of supporting artists and through LMCC and other different organizations. But this one's a really special organization. I've had the pleasure of being what they call a senior artist. So I've stayed there for a couple of years, and I help support the new cohort. And the other one is Project for Empty Space, which is in Newark, New Jersey. And so I use that space as a space to put my top secret work where, you know, because we don't have doors at Silver Art. So I put all the new stuff that people aren't seeing quite yet. And I absolutely love the Project for Empty Space community. Jasmine, Wahi, and Becca are the co-owners, founders, and really badass feminist women. They even have the Badass Women Awards that happen every year. And what I love about being in New York is, I mean, being an artist is so hard. There's just so many ups and downs, and most people don't understand the lifestyle. There's a lot of times where I work very late or I'm on the road a lot. I also teach at Brown University, so I commute every week and teach. And the artist academic lifestyle can feel very like confusing for a lot of people. But when you have community, and I don't operate from a competitive space. I'm a cheerleader for my friends in this art industry. They are for me too, which is, I'm very fortunate for that. But when you operate in community, you have a built-in like sort of team of people who are a support system, who really understand the sacrifice in what you do. And so that you can be of service to the people outside of the art system, because I'm more interested in having conversations outside of the art world. I say all that to say I'm so grateful for my studio spaces in New York and New Jersey, and that I have built-in community and artists that I get to see and hang out with every day. So it feels like we're having a party in a studio all the time, which it actually is true. Like, we play music and we give each other studio visits. So yeah, it just makes for a lively experience.
Yeah, it's wonderful. What do you feel is the purpose of art?
You're asking all the deep philosophical questions here. The purpose of art. I love this line that is in one of my video art pieces, Middle Passage for Dreams, where I document creatives in this meditative space. And in the video art project, one of my friends says, she says, artists are like prophets. We see a future that's coming before others see it. And we say to people, hey, this future is coming and it's almost here. And so our jobs is to be visionaries. And that can look like creating something out of nothing, right? That's like words on a page, or that is, you know, images on a canvas. But we have the ability to work outside of the structure, the systems that have been created, that are created by humans that, you know, are oftentimes very problematic and have even been self-destructive. And we can redefine and rethink what humanity can be and what this world can be. And that's our job. You know, yes, is it a commodity? It could be, but it doesn't have to be. It can be ideas. Yes, it can be, of course, intellectual, and it can be some way for an elite group to have a conversation. It doesn't have to be that either. Everyone's influenced by the arts, from the fashion world to the music world. You know, I mean, we do have a really, at least in terms of the visual and the, you know, intersectional performance art, we do have a really important role to be experimental and to really keep the integrity, to also get very, very quiet and very clear as to what's happening in our souls and in our hearts and our minds, and to process our external experience from the space of truth-telling. At least that's how I approach it. That might not be how others do, but I do think that's the role and the function of art. And that is why I do what I do. It's not easy work, but it's compelling work. And I get to sleep really well at night knowing that I get to make impact. And I don't have to compromise much of who I am. I really am myself day in and day out. And for that, I'm very grateful.
This has been a wonderful conversation. I appreciate your time. This is our final question. And in many ways, you've touched on it, but perhaps we can just dive a little deeper. As an artist, what do you feel is your role?
So, yes, my role is to be a truth teller, quote unquote, or prophet, quote unquote. I'm going to give you all of these lofty, big things. You know, there's another quote I'll even throw out there. And this is a reading I do with my students when I teach, is, you know, there's a James Baldwin important essay. The artist's struggle for integrity. It's a 1963 speech that he gave to a community church. And he talks about the role of the artist is to maintain or to be on the fringes of society so that we can look into society from a neutral space, right? So we can't be so engrossed in whether it's consumer culture, popular culture, like whatever it is. We have to be able to look and interrogate it so that we can also be cultural producers. So as a cultural producer, I have to be able to disentangle from what I'm being fed through either the media or through, you know, any sort of mainstream cookie cutter sort of packaging. And then I have to be able to think, okay, but what else is there? And he describes this, James Baldwin describes this as a very lonely path, because when you are on the outside of something, it inherently is quite lonely. So what is our role? What is my role as a cultural producer who sometimes has to be on the outside looking in and who wants to find an audience? So I have to go back in and build a relationship and translate this to an audience who didn't take that journey with me. You know, the artist could be a trickster. That's how they could be in that role. They could be a misfit. They can be a conformer or pretend to be one. And it goes on and on and on. So who am I in all of that? I would like to say I'm a magician. Because every day I get to make something out of nothing, and then I get to play in that mystery and that wonder with curiosity. So yes, I'm an artist, I'm a cultural producer, and I'm a magician.
Well, thank you for your magic.
My black girl magic, hashtag.
Yes, your black girl magic. Yes, yes, yes. This has been a delight. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Cerebral Women Art Talks podcast. For additional content, please visit cerebralwomen.com and be sure to follow Cerebral Women on Instagram.